to Guerrilla Radio, recorded April 1st, 2026, nearly 3 months since his abduction in a raid Venezuelan authorities say killed more than 75 people. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro stood in a Brooklyn court before Judge Alvin Hellerstein in his second appearance, charged with narco-terrorism and drug trafficking. The case can be seen as a bellwether of the Trump administration's new understanding of international law, in that Maduro's fate is likely being closely watched by other leaders called out by the American president. Leaders like Colombia's Gustavo Petro, who is currently the subject of two Department of Justice investigations. Dan Kovalik, a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. Dan represented unions whose membership were targeted by Colombia's death squads, served as a foreign observer to elections in the country, and is now President Petro's legal representative in the United States. Kovalik's book titles include No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interest, The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care, and his latest, co-authored with Jeremy Kuzmarov, Syria, Anatomy of Regime Change. Dan Kovalik in the first half. And following an epic seven-month-long campaign, the NDP has elected a new leader. Avi Lewis, former television host and son of NDP icon Stephen Lewis, won convincingly on the first ballot over the weekend, and already he's making all the right enemies for voicing support of the humanity of Palestinian and Lebanese populations being bombed by Israel. Eve Engler is an activist, journalist, and author of countless articles and essays detailing Canada's foreign policy history. He's written a dozen books on the subject, including Stand on Guard for Whom, A People's History of the Canadian Military, House of Mirrors, Justin Trudeau's Foreign Policy, Left-Right Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada, and his latest Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. Eve was, too, famously an aspirant for the leadership of the NDP, whose campaign to be included in the debates challenged the party's commitment to the democratic process. It proved a challenge the backroom rulers of the party couldn't meet. His latest article at eveengler.com insists, as right leaps to pressure Lewis, we must push left. Eve Engler and what next for the Lewis-led NDP and more in the second half. But first, Dan Kovalik and trying to read the mixed American messages on Colombia's outgoing president, Gustavo Petro. Welcome back to the show, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's always my great pleasure, of course. And Dan, it's been a while since we spoke back in late October, and a lot has changed in Venezuela since we last talked. Back then, Gustavo Petro, too, was blazing against the lethal U.S. attacks on boats in the Caribbean, damning Trump's regime and drawing fire from the White House for it. He's since been to Washington and met with Trump. Dan, it seemed to be an amicable encounter. Did that meeting take the heat off Petro?
Well, it's a good question. It did not get him delisted from the OFAC list, which is this economic blacklist he was put on at the end of October. So that didn't happen. I would say, yes, it took some heat off him. Now, since that time, there was a New York Times article on March 20th that said he was that Petro's being investigated by the Department of Justice for alleged ties to drug traffickers. And that was very concerning. But there was actually a follow-up story in the New York Times yesterday saying that the DOJ has reassured Petro that, in fact, there aren't any plans for a criminal indictment against him. So I would say, to some degree, there has been pressure taken off him.
Well, I'm looking at that article right now, the New York Times piece by Annie Coryell, and she, that's of March 31st date. And yeah, as you say, it's the header is U.S. assures Colombian president he does not face charges right now. And in it, she cites the Justice Department, but they're unnamed sources. So I'm not sure what that means, if it's an official pronouncement or just some scuttlebutt that she heard coming out of the DOJ that was strategically released to her to, I don't know, put Petro at his ease so that he wouldn't criticize Trump in the run-up to the elections in Colombia at the end of next month, or what?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the original story from March 20th was also based on anonymous sources, and it was thought that they purposefully leaked the claim about the investigation is kind of a warning to Petro. But then, of course, now they've through also anonymous sources are saying, well, you don't have much to worry about. So it's quite interesting. I really don't know what is going on. We can only guess, as you say, because it's anonymous sources. So, you know, we don't even know the veracity of any of this, to be honest.
Well, and of course, beyond trusting everything the New York Times says, as we all should and we are bound to do. But as I said, the election's coming up 31st of May, and it is the successor is believed, or the front runner is believed to be Cepeda. He is the protege of Petro. What are his and I guess the assumption is that they don't that the Americans don't want to give Ivan Cepeda any oxygen, so they're going to lay back and not criticize Petro or his protege too much. Does that make any sense of it?
Well, if they were smart, that would be their ploy, because yes,
that's out then.
The truth is, the more they have put Petro under attack, the more his popularity numbers have risen. I mean, so again, if they have any smarts, they would lay off, because the more they go after Petro and Cepeda, the more popular those two guys get. So. Well, that is just a fact. Yeah.
I saw you in another interview, and you referred to Petro as a rock star in Colombia right now.
Yeah, I mean, I saw, well, again, his poll numbers are very good, but also, you know, when he goes out and speaks, he draws huge crowds. I saw one video when he appeared at a university, and when the students who were outside heard that he was there, they ran. I mean, they just started running across the field to get into the building to see him, you know. So amongst the people, he's very popular, you know, amongst poor people and working class people and indigenous people. He is a rock star. They love him.
But there still is, within Colombia, a narrow divide between the left and right. We've talked about it, you and I, many times in the past. I've just read a piece by Craig Murray, the former British diplomat, talking about the abduction in Venezuela of Maduro there. And he is suggesting that Maduro told the military, Craig Murray is, that the military was told by Maduro that if there was an attempt to kidnap him, that they should stand down rather than risk not only a land invasion by the Americans, but a civil war being kicked off within the country with the right wing in that country taking to the streets as they have done in the past. And there is a narrow divide there, although not so narrow between the far left and right in Venezuela as there is in Colombia. Is that still the case in Colombia when Petro is received as a rock star, as you describe him? Is the right wing still an ascendant threat there?
Well, I don't think as much as they were before. I mean, I think they're very unpopular. Obviously, they have a certain amount of support, certainly amongst the elite and more well-to-do people and in various regions of the country. But I mean, I think they lost a lot of legitimacy due to the violence that they perpetrated under their rule and due to corruption. So, look, they're still there. They're still a force, but I think they don't have the support that they had at one point. Well, and the other thing is they got support to begin with, in part because of people's fear of the FARC, and which has been disbanded, right, through a peace process. There are some FARC dissidents still running around, but they're not the threat that they used to be. And that's what really, you know, the right wing really depended on that threat to keep, you know, getting elected.
Well, but there still is. America is big on the drug war, reviving that old saw and using it to arrest Maduro. He's charged as a drug trafficker, ridiculous, risible charges. They've brought the same allegations against Petro. And yet Petro is waging a war against drugs within Colombia, one that the New York Times article suggests that his successor, Mr. Cepeda, is not right on board with, at least not in the military aspects of it. Is that correct?
I think that's true. I mean, Petro, first of all, definitely prioritizes peaceful means of eradicating drugs over military means. He's done a great job at volunteer crop substitution, for example. And he prides himself on being able to seize cocaine without killing people. So, I mean, he definitely does not prioritize military means at drug eradication, though he does use it at times and in certain instances. And, yeah, I would say Ivan Cepeda is probably going to be even more opposed to using the military for those purposes.
Petro has accused the Americans of interfering in the upcoming election in Colombia, as they've interfered with the democratic process throughout the region. What effect is America having on the pre-election period right now in Colombia? Is he right in his condemnation of the Americans for interfering?
Well, again, I think the big interference has been the way they've been going after Petro by this OFAC designation, again, by at least the claim that the DOJ has been investigating him. I certainly think those are very significant means of interference. Beyond that, I don't know what other interference is happening, but I'd be shocked if there wasn't, right? I mean, they definitely don't want Ivan Cepeda to win. He's very left-wing. He's more left-wing than Petro, so I mean, that would be a big loss to the United States if Cepeda wins. So I'm sure we will see various forms of interference. The other bigger means of interference has been what's been happening at the Ecuador border with Ecuadorian forces crossing the border into Colombia. And that, you know, has been destabilizing. And Petro does think that is an attack against him, really, and his government.
Yeah, let's talk about that in a second. But before that, Dan, assuming that Cepeda does inherit Petro's popularity and becomes the next president, is there any indication that the Americans have a plan to militarily interfere, or do they have an agent like a Colombian Juan Guaido or something like this in the wings in Colombia?
Well, I don't know that they do, but the Colombian military itself has been captive of the right wing for a long time. I think Petro has tried to, change that, but has not been able to completely purge the leadership of right wing elements. So they always represent a certain danger. There's also many armed groups running around Colombia that could also be used to go after Cepeda. In fact, Petro himself just survived an assassination attempt in February that came from one of the armed groups in the Caribbean coast. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of candidates that the U.S. could use to try to pull off some sort of coup.
There was some kind of air helicopter thing or something as well.
That was it. He was in a helicopter at the time with his two daughters, and they got word that there was going to be an attempt to shoot down the helicopter. So the helicopter ended up circling over the Caribbean for like 4 hours to try to avoid being shot at.
Jeez, talk about walking a tightrope. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dan Kovalik. Dan's a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. He's represented unions whose membership were targeted by Colombia's nefarious death squads, served as foreign observer to elections in the country. He's now President Petro's legal representative in the U.S. Dan's books include No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests, The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. His latest is co-authored with Jeremy Kuzmarov, Syria, Anatomy of Regime Change. Dan, you also wrote as part of your plot, the Plot 2 series, The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. You visited Iran in 2017. You wrote, I was just reading the introduction to the book, and you dedicated to the people of Iran. What are you hearing, Dan, from the friends you made there now?
Well, I mean, they're very, defiant and resolved to win this war against the U.S. and Israel. But, I mean, they're under attack. I mean, they are under constant bombardment. I visited Tehran and Isfahan. Both are cities that are being carpet bombed by the United States. And so, you know, people are definitely living under great threat of being killed. I mean, that's just a fact. Meanwhile, I mean, like, Isfahan is just this incredible historic city with amazing ancient architecture, and it's being destroyed, you know? And I thought when I was there at the time, I thought, wow, it's amazing how they've, you know, preserved all this architecture and ruins. And I thought to myself, well, I guess that's because the U.S. hasn't yet bombed it, you know? Well, that's happening right now. I mean, the U.S. and Israel are destroying thousands of, buildings that have stood for certainly hundreds of years. And it's just heartbreaking, really.
Well, UNESCO World Heritage sites abound. It's not only that there's all these beautiful buildings there, which there certainly are, but if you look inside of these buildings, the artwork within them is just indescribable. It's amazing and unique and beautiful. I've seen many photographs inside the mosques and in other buildings there, of the tile work and so forth. And that was the first thing I thought about, too, was would the vandals of the West dare destroy something that is a part of world heritage and is just something so beautiful? It seems impossible, but there you have it.
Well, yeah, the West has been doing that throughout the region. In Yemen, they destroy, you know, the war in Yemen, which a few people knew was even happening, the Obama-sponsored war against Yemen. There were many UNESCO sites destroyed there. Yeah. Many UNESCO sites that have been destroyed in Gaza during the recent war, many in Lebanon, many in Syria. I mean, the West is on a demolition campaign throughout the region. It's unbelievable. Like you said, these are world heritage sites. You know, these are things that all of humanity should be valuing and protecting. Instead, they're being destroyed.
What are Americans, Dan? I don't watch the mainstream news anymore, I must admit. What is the news in the United States portraying about this assault against world heritage and against the civilian population of Iran by the United States, let alone what Israel's doing in Lebanon and Palestine?
They're really sanitizing both those situations. You're really not getting a good picture of what's happening there, of the destruction, of the human toll that's being exacted against these peoples. You know, you're learning about that through social media. The press is really trying to protect the war by covering that stuff up.
Well, your president is set to speak tonight. This is April 1st. I don't know if this is an April Fool's joke on his part or not. I wouldn't put it past him. I don't know if he's as crazy, really, as he appears to be to the rest of the world, if this is part of the old madman theory that Kissinger put forward for Nixon so that people believe he's actually crazy enough to drop a nuclear bomb and risk a global conflagration by doing that, or if he actually just really is as mad as a hatter. What's your opinion on that, and what do you expect him to say tonight?
Well, I don't know for sure. Again, with Donald Trump, it's hard to predict, you know, what he's going to do from one moment to the next. But there's some indication he may try to declare victory so he can get out, because this war is disastrous for him. I mean, it's destroying the economy. It's leading to inflation. These are things he said he was going to fix as president. Instead, he's making them so much worse. So I think he's trying to find a way out. And yes, the only way to do it is to somehow claim victory. So that might be what he's trying to do tonight. I'd certainly like to see an end to this war, but I'm not sure if the U.S. pulls out, whether that means Israel and Iran will stop fighting. I'm not sure that's the case.
Well, and we have to see what's going on in Iran as part of the larger war in all of West Asia right now. Dan, just last week, Cardinal Pizzaballa was denied entrance into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Palestine, the first time that that has happened to a Catholic figure in centuries. Dan, you talked about after your visit to Iran, you've written about and talked about the spiritual effect on you and how it brought you back to the church. Is this a holy war?
Well, I would say it's an unholy war. I would say it is a war against really religion itself. I mean, against Islam, against Christianity. I would say it's an unholy war. It's really a war against humanity is what it is.
Well, you wrote on your Twitter feed, you talked about last week about the anniversary of the assassination of Bishop Oscar Romero in El Salvador, sanctified in the meantime, and the broader war by America against the liberation theology, against the Church of Liberation. Could you briefly explain what the Church of Liberation is? Because that seems to have been buried, at least in the North American context, and what that war against religion means.
Yeah, liberation theology was a movement, mostly in Latin America, but not entirely there, mostly in the global south. It sprung out of the Second Vatican Council, which was in 1962. And it really was an effort by a number of religious and a number of Catholics, progressive Catholics, to really bring the church back to what it had been in the first few centuries before it became the Church of the Holy Roman Empire, right? Before it became the Church of Empire, it was the Church of the Poor, and they wanted to return it to that. And the U.S. saw this as a great threat against U.S. domination of these countries. And so it went on a killing spree to kill priests and bishops and others, to wipe out liberation theology, which it largely did. There's some remnants of it. Pope Francis actually grew out of that in Argentina, but mostly it's been destroyed, and it was destroyed through violence.
And now an American pope sits at the heart of the Catholic Church. We're fast running out of time, Dan, but I did want to get back to Ecuador just briefly because it seems emblematic to me. The presidents of Venezuela and Colombia are under threats of drug charges. Meanwhile, Ecuador has taken the first place of drug exportation. And fittingly, its president is Daniel Noboa, a oligarchic billionaire, son of a billionaire father, intrinsically a part of the Latin American drugs trade for many, many years. He's not under suspicion. He's not under attack. He doesn't get mentioned in Mr. Trump's expounding speeches against the drugs and the war that he would wage against them.
No, in fact, yeah. While his government is knee deep in drug trafficking, you're right. The U.S. doesn't care about that. That's not the real issue. The real issue is whether your government toes the U.S. line, and Ecuador does. So they're fine. You know, as far as the U.S. is concerned, they're fine, whether they're dealing in drugs. And the U.S. now has boots on the ground in Ecuador, again, ostensibly to fight drugs, but I think really to project U.S. power throughout the region.
Interesting times, Dan, and we're all on the edges of our seats waiting for the pronouncements of the fool president or the president in fool tonight, if the, you know, as we speak. Thanks a lot, Dan, for coming on again, eh?
Thanks, Chris. Always a pleasure.
And I want everyone to stick around after the break. I'll be back with Eve Angler, and we're going to talk about what next for the Avi Lewis-led NDP up here in Canada. Thanks, Dan.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favourite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, ever, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, following an epic 7 months long campaign, the NDP has elected a new leader. Avi Lewis, former television host and son of NDP icon Stephen Lewis, won convincingly on the first ballot over the weekend, and already he's making all the right enemies for voicing support of the humanity of Palestinian and Lebanese populations currently being bombed by Israel. Eve Angler is an activist, journalist, and author of countless articles and essays detailing Canada's foreign policy history. He's written a dozen books on the subject, including Stand on Guard for Whom, A People's History of the Canadian Military, House of Mirrors, Justin Trudeau's Foreign Policy, Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada, and his latest is Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, that co-written with Owen Schock. Eve was too famously an aspirant for the leadership of the NDP, whose campaign to be included in the debates challenged the party's commitment to the democratic process, a challenge the backroom rulers of the party couldn't meet. His latest article at eveangler.com insists, as right leaps to pressure Lewis, we must push left. Welcome back to the program, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, Eve, the Times of Israel describes Avi Lewis as an anti-Zionist, while Canada's AIPAC, the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs Leadership, are shaking their collective head with a, quote, deep sense of sadness over his election. Is that even enough to reassure those who doubt the NDP's commitment to peace in West Asia?
No.